Which secret?
The paid taxis, the coupon code 4141.
Well, generally on Sunday mornings, you don't need to use the code at all.
Yeah, I told you.
Yes.
I do just in case.
Smart. Just in case we forgot. All right, good morning, everybody. We discussed at length that the purpose of the neshama, the soul coming down to this earth, is in order to subjugate the evil inclination, and good to see you guys, and to transform darkness to light. And we do that through the 248 positive commandments, which, as we discussed at length, are the channels through which the divine energy is manifest down here. So in reverse, when we do a mitzvah, we connect to the 248 divine manifestations. Using the analogy of the body, which again, with the precaution that we're trying to anthropomorphize, or we're trying not to anthropomorphize, we're trying to be careful not to turn God into a human form. But this is the best we got, right? We look at the body, we look at the human experience, and we know that we're a microcosm. So we reflect back at what the divine structure might be, even if the divine structure is nothing like our comprehension, kind of like the idea of looking in a mirror, right? You're looking in a mirror, you see a reflection of yourself, but there's none of the physical matter that makes up the person is actually in the mirror. Even though it looks like the person, it's something altogether different, right? So when we are looking at the person and the human experience, and we're saying we're reflecting what God is being manifest, we're talking about two entirely different things. But the tools that we have is the visual, or the intellectual comprehension of what the human experience is. So if there is this divine structure, we have right and left. Right is generally known as chesed, kindness. Left is known as gevura, discipline. Right is the giving, the left is the holding back. And we know that at the core, everything is, even the holding back is a form of kindness, right? I definitely, if it's coming from God, it's all love, it's all good, it's all positive. So even the holding back, in a sense, is a form of kindness. But yet it leans to the left side. It leans to the side of gevura, to the side of discipline. So in the right side, the right arm being chesed, kindness, and the left arm being gevura, discipline, we have, and again, following the flow here, the right is kindness, left is discipline. The arms, the organs of the body, are the divine manifestations as God manifests himself down in this earth. And we connect through that through doing the 248 positive commandments. right? If that flow continues, so then the commandments are ultimately God's manifestations down here, and they show up in two general categories, right and left. Right being those mitzvahs that are predominantly chesed, they're all chesed. And then you have those mitzvahs, those commandments that are chesed, but as they're enclosed, as they're in the disguise, so to speak, of gevurah, of discipline. And these are the two things for which the land of Israel is praised for. It is a land flowing with milk and honey. Milk is white. Milk is all chesed. Milk is all kindness. And the honey is a process. It's not, even though honey is sweet, but it comes about through a process. The bees, the negativity associated with that, and so on. And these are two kindnesses, the Alter Rebbe says, like the difference between a kindness from a mother or from a father. The kindness of a mother is white, it's all good, it's all love. Kindness of a father is a little more calculated, it's a more structured, and so on and so forth. So that's where we got to last time. So we are on the bottom of page 16, if you have the handout. There's a few more copies here if anybody would like. And he says like this, Shehu bechinas hamshachas elikus ayidei mitzvahs maisius. This is the drawing down. Remember, the commandments are about divine revelation. So this is the drawing down of godliness, of divine revelation, through the action mitzvahs. Ramache varen demalka, which is the 248 organs of the king, right? This is Israel, land flowing with milk and honey. 248 organs of the king being manifest down here below. We're on bottom of page 16. The Eretz Yisrael mechuvenes keneged Eretz Yisrael shalemayla. It says that the physical Israel below is spiritually positioned beneath the spiritual Israel above. So the physical Israel below has a spiritual alignment with the spiritual Israel above. He brings around in parentheses here from the Medrash on Shir HaShirim that the temple below, it says that your dwelling place is aligned. Reference to the temple in Jerusalem, the Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem is aligned. What does it mean it's aligned? It's aligned spiritually beneath the spiritual temple above. So what are we talking about here? What is this idea of alignment? We're talking about a spiritual consciousness and a physical reality. How do those two things line up? So, you know, the reality is that we have limited comprehension on what this means, but I don't know if it was in the context of this class, but we, you know, something interesting that we think about, there's a, in science, we know that the universe is ever expanding, right? Everybody's familiar with that concept, right? The universe started as a little tiny nothing, and then it's constantly expanding. It's a really easy thing to say because it's totally beyond any of our comprehension what that even means. Not only what it existentially means, but like, what does it actually even mean? What does that mean it's expanding? But I'll just challenge one thought. And that is, if you were able to, if it was possible, huh? Yeah.
And they say, like, in 500 years, Africa will now split completely from the north to the south.
Okay, so that's all within a physical consciousness, right? Now, if we took a spaceship, and we were able to get to that place, it's not possible, but conceptually, we're able to get to that place where the universe is constantly expanding, and you had a telescope, and you were able to see what was on the other side, what would you see? Well, how could a universe, how could a physical universe expand into a place that doesn't exist, right? In other words, if you tell me there's this big gaping hole, and the universe is expanding into that gaping hole, I can accept that, right? Then the question is, how big is that gaping hole? But if you're telling me that the universe itself is expanding, what's it expanding into? So, which I'm not going to attempt to answer because it's beyond my comprehension. No, I'm talking about the universe, not the Earth. The universe, the whole, whatever we know about space and the galaxies and you know, outer space and beyond, that there's, you know, there's a wall to this universe. That wall is constantly expanding, right? So the question is, when you get there, you actually, in theory, are at the transition point between a physical consciousness and a spiritual consciousness, right? That's the transition point, which, by the way, you don't have to go there to experience that, because we experience that right here in our present space, in our present experience. We are constantly experiencing, if we just choose to tap into it. There's a place where our physical consciousness ends. And there's that place which is where the spiritual consciousness is. And what's the transition point, right? There's a point where we don't understand anymore and we have the capacity to move into that spiritual consciousness, but there's a transition point. And that transition point is where we let go of what we hold on to. Stanley, do you mind grabbing the door? I think someone's trying to get in. Thank you. There's a place where that transition, where we have to let go of our consciousness, we have to let go in order to be able to move into that spiritual space, which again, it's not such a novel idea if you think about it, right? Because in any relationship, as long as you're filling the space of the relationship, then you're not crossing that line. So in order to fill the space, in order to create space for someone else, you have to let go of yourself. In Hebrew, it's called bittul, the humility, the self-nullification, putting ourselves aside to create space for someone else is where that transition takes place. But we do this intellectually, right? If you want to have a relationship with God and your whole foundation of that relationship is I'm going to understand God, you're never going to get there because God is beyond comprehension. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't make the effort to understand God. You need to make the effort to understand God. Because that's the Torah's instruction. The Torah is given to us to attempt to understand God, but with the understanding that we're not going to. We're only going to understand as much as we can understand, and then we're going to transition into faith. We spoke about this yesterday at services, that the Torah's instruction, the commandment is to know God, v'yadaita hayom, to know God. Well, how could you know God? The answer is you can know as much as you can know, and then you transition to faith. If I say, I believe that the sun is shining, you say, you don't have to believe the sun is shining. Walk outside and you'll see that the sun is shining. So I'm cheapening my quality of intellect if I choose to believe something that I can know. Right? You say, maybe I can't know it right now, but I can work towards knowing it. I can know certain things about godliness. I can know certain things about God. And if I open my eyes and if I take time to study, right, that I will know a lot more about God. It doesn't mean I will know God. I will know more about God. And then at a certain point, and by the way, the child knows so much, and the adult, the 20-year-old and the 40-year-old and the 80-year-old, we all know different things. And each of us are spiritual children based on our level of knowledge, right? But at a certain point, the child has to graduate from being a believer into being a knower, right? The level of faith that a child has as an adult, we know that. But then when we graduate into that new space of knowing, then our faith becomes a higher faith. And then when we graduate into that space of knowing, then the faith becomes yet a higher faith. And so it goes.
As you grow, so you expand. That's right. And that expansion,
we ought to.
And that expansion was the aptitude and expansion of the universe.
I'm drawing a parallel between as we as humans expand our knowledge, the transition point between knowledge and faith becomes a different transition, becomes a higher transition point. Similar to how the universe is constantly expanding, And at a certain point, we have to transition from the physical consciousness into a spiritual consciousness. So that same parallel, I'm positing that that's the same parallel. And just as we understand that we don't understand what's on the other side of that ever-expanding universe, but we see that the universe is expanding, so therefore we have faith that whatever it is, it's something beyond our comprehension. Similarly, I'm saying that within our intellectual capacity for what we understand, we then come to a place where we don't understand anymore. But we understand that we don't understand, and we understand that what's on the other side of that divide is faith. And that's when you move into faith. Yeah. So that is to say that the spiritual, the physical space of Israel, the spiritual space of the temple of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, is aligned with its spiritual counterpart in heaven. Now, what does that mean? It means that whatever limitation the physical reality has, it's merely a mirror of what's in the spiritual consciousness. We're not going to understand what it is in the spiritual consciousness because we're finite human beings. But what we could understand is that whatever it is a mirror of, that is aligned spiritually with the physical space of Israel and the temple. And even though in the physical reality it manifests itself in a physical space, but that too is its properties. This is a really important point for the punchline of this discourse. The spiritual manifests itself in the physical, and it's exact. You're going to say if it's spiritual, so it's beyond time and space, so why does it show up in time and space? That is because the properties of whatever that is in its spiritual dimension, as it manifests itself in a physical consciousness, it becomes defined in its finite definition as such. Again, using our mirror analogy. The reason why when you look into a mirror, it's a human face that's looking back at you, that's because you're a human being. Even though the mirror is not made out of the same physical matter as the person looking into the mirror, but because you're a human being, so therefore the mirror is going to reflect a human face. If you put a dog in front of the mirror is going to reflect the dog. Why? Because the physical matter is a dog. So the mirror is reflecting a dog. In other words, even though these two things have nothing to do with each other, I'm a person, that's a mirror, but because they have a relationship with each other, and what's showing up in the mirror is a direct result of what's standing in front of the mirror. So therefore, what's showing up in the mirror is going to be a manifestation of what's showing up in front of the mirror, even though the matter, the physical matter, are made up of two totally different things. In other words, because something has a relationship, therefore, whatever the nature of that relationship is, it shows up there between the two. You know, from a faith-based standpoint, that's a given. But even on a non-faith-based standpoint, so I went to visit my doctor last week, and we were talking about various different things. Great doctor, we like to hang out and schmooze. We don't always talk medicine. And he's not necessarily a man of faith. I don't know that he isn't, but it's not definitely, he's much more a man of science. But it's very interesting that even as a man of science, he recognizes, he calls it the universe. The universe brings certain things together. In other words, there's a reality why there's an energy. There's an energy that exists in this room that can be tapped into. From a spiritual standpoint, it's a given. But people that are sensitive, right? People that are very sensitized are able to feel things when they come into a room. And that's not because they're spiritual people. It's that they just have a sensitivity. We had a gentleman yesterday here at the Kiddush who was talking about studying. He's an attorney and he studies facial expressions. There's a whole world of science to study facial expressions. What is the face reflecting the person's experiencing? right? What's when you have somebody on the stand and you want to kind of pull information out of them, if you know how to read their face, you know how to guide the questioning. Is that a spiritual thing? No. It's an emotion which is ethereal, manifesting itself in the physical. Fine, but what is the fact? What is the learned fact? The learned fact is that an ethereal emotion manifests itself in a physical expression. So why is my right eyebrow going up? Because I'm feeling curious inside my heart. I'm emotionally feeling curious. Why does that have to do with my right eyebrow going up? The reality is that there's a relationship. Now, in the body itself, it's easier to accept that because we're one organism, right? But there's any two things that have a relationship with each other, there is a connection, there is a result, there is a bonding that takes place between those two things. And that's within a physical consciousness, which all of us experience every single day. And if we embraced it more, our lives would probably be a little easier, even on a physical consciousness, let alone if we believe in God. In other words, when we encounter another person, if we believe that we were meant to be together, to interact with each other, we're going to look at it in a different way. We're not going to get all as we say, we're not going to get all out of sorts. We're going to say, okay, what's the opportunity here, right? There's endless books of personal development and self-development that talk about this. And they're not necessarily faith-based books. Let alone if you bring faith into the equation and we understand that God is orchestrating everything. So there's no chance here. Every interaction you have with a person, with an experience, with a physical object, it's because there's a relationship there. So when we talk about these kind of, I don't want to say existential, these cosmic realities, right? That Israel is a place and it's specifically a given place. And the temple in Jerusalem is specifically in a particular place. And these are all divinely orchestrated. That's because in heaven, even though heaven is spiritual, these physical manifestations are directly aligned with its spiritual counterpart. It's a manifestation. I mean, first it's a manifestation. It's a beam me up, Scotty kind of thing, right? It's a direct result of the spiritual energy being manifest in creation, right? But we don't necessarily see the beam. And then there is the flow that comes from it. Then there's the ongoing flow of divine energy that comes down through the efforts, which we're going to talk about in a minute of the observance of Torah and mitzvahs. Yes.
You know there was two big Hamikdash, right? One of them King Solomon, the other one Herod.
King Solomon built the first one. The second one was not built by Herod. It was built under the instruction of Ezra and Nehemiah. Later on, Herod remodeled the Beis HaMikdash. So that's why it was ultimately credited to him, because he did this massive transformation, but he didn't build it. Yeah, so the what Herod actually did was he didn't renovate the temple structure itself was there. What he did was he expanded. You can come with us to Israel in between April 1st through 7th if you like, and we'll give you a first-hand tour. But what he did was he actually expanded the Temple Mount. He renovated, he remodeled, he added wall cover, I think he repaved the inside of the temple, recoded the temple and stuff like that. But his main introduction was he brought in these Roman kind of introductions. They expanded the floor of the Temple Mount, which was an amazing feat. I mean, today it's not so novel. They're doing it right here on the Beltline. You basically put up a retaining wall and they expanded the Temple Mount. They put this massive retaining wall all the way around Jerusalem and filled it in and created all these underground chambers and so on. Herod was not a spiritual man at all. He was a pretty rough and tumble kind of guy. Okay, so this makes sense, this concept of the spiritual alignment. Okay. So now with that understanding, we could understand, first of all, the next five words, which is V'lachein ikra mitzvah su be'eretz Yisrael davka. That's why the main observance of the commandments are in Israel. So gesund. If the physical universe is a manifestation of this primordial being, and the universe's existence is dependent, in other words, the divine flow that energized existence is dependent on the observance of the divine commandments, right? That's the formula. You do God's commandments, you bring down godly light. Because the world was created for the commandments, so therefore, when we do the commandments, we bring down the godly light, the world exists, the world is nurtured, the world is energized, right? As we discussed at length, when we take care of our body, when we take care of the 248 organs of our body, we're a healthy person. Exercise, you take care of your heart, take care of your brain, eat that fish oil, right? All that stuff. When you do all the right stuff, then your body is healthy. You don't take care of it, the body begins to break down. Spiritually, it works the same way. Or I should say physically, universally, it works the same way. Because we observe God's commandments, we bring down the divine energy into the world that gives the world its nurture. Now, if the majority of the commandments are dependent on the land of Israel, sacrifices, many of the commandments associated with the land, the crops, the tithing, the portions of the land we have to leave over for the poor, the gifts of the land that we have to give to the priest, to the Levite, the sabbatical year, the Jubilee year, and many other laws connected with the land of Israel, which are dependent on the land of Israel, right? I don't know the exact number, but it's high up on that 248, right? People get nervous. You want me to keep all 613 commandments? First of all, 365 of them are negative. They're don't do's. So some of them might be a little difficult, but for the most part, we're not doing most of the ones we're not supposed to do. And then in terms of the positive commandments, the 248 positive commandments, so most of them we can't observe today anyway. And if you're in the diaspora, you for sure can't observe them. So there's very few mitzvahs you have to actually do to observe God's commandments today. But the point being is that the majority of the commandments are dependent on the land of Israel. So number one, right there, we see why Israel is so important. Because in the rest of the world, everything flows through Israel. If we in the United States, and the Rebbe once said that if the nations that fought against Israel understood how dependent they are on Israel, they would go there and protect the land of Israel. Right? The very sustenance of existence flows through Israel. So now the question becomes a much stronger question. Why did the spies not want to go into Israel? We'll come back to that in a second, but let me just emphasize this point. So Israel is the lifeline of all of existence. All of this physical existence is the lifeline goes through Israel. It flows through Israel. By the way, our prayers go the other direction, right? When we pray in the diaspora, our prayers go to Jerusalem. They go to the place of the temple, even till today, the place of the Holy of Holies, and from there they go up. So this is the... Yes. I mean, that's not a joke. Yes, it's absolutely the case. So it's... For sure. Whether people consciously know it or not, we're drawn to that. We're drawn to that because it's the divine channel. It's a fascinating concept, right? You've got the window to heaven right there, right? That's the transition point. If you think about it, actually, so we just talked about the expanding universe. It actually works the other way. The real reality is that the expanded universe comes together into this place in Jerusalem, and that's the transition point, right? We think linearly. So if the universe is expanding, so the transition point's out there. But if you think about it, it actually works the other way around. The transition point comes to here into Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem to the Holy of Holies, and that's where that transition takes place. Okay, so now let's understand what's going on with the spies. Any questions on that? Everybody get that point, why Israel's so important? By the way, if we can talk a little bit about why Israel's so contentious also. If it's so holy, if it's so important, why is it so contentious? So in brief, the concept is like this, that negativity, let's just focus on this concept. Negativity requires negativity to exist, right? If you get into a fight with, we tell this to our children all the time, you get into a fight with your brother or your sister, and they want to go negative, and you're not prepared to go negative, the fight's going to end, right? You have to meet the negativity with the negativity. If your sister's trying to irritate you, I'm saying sister because I got six daughters, but if your sister's trying to irritate you and you're not going to become irritable, the fight's going to end. I mean, it gets boring very quickly when you try to pick on someone and they're just not picking it up, right? It's very funny when you can actually, when one kid gets it, right? And at least even just in that particular interaction, like it's going to laugh at you. Like, I'm not picking it up. I'm not getting it. My uncle tells me a story. I had, my mother had three brothers, and my youngest uncle, short little guy, he laughs, his whole body shakes, the whole room shakes. He's just a character. And he tells me the story. He was driving with his oldest brother, who was not well. They were driving to work one day, and his oldest brother was, he wasn't feeling good. He was sick at the end of it. He died relatively young, and he wasn't feeling good. And, we all get in it when we're in a bad mood. Sometimes we take it out on other people. So he was picking on his little brother. And these were grown-ups. And he wasn't picking on him, calling him names, obviously. He was picking a fight of some sort. And his younger brother got what was going on. Like, he understood that his older brother was just not feeling good, and he was taking it out on him. So he said to him, in only the way this uncle of mine, Avraham Esha, could do, he said something to him like, "You're trying to start a fight? It's not going to work." And he started laughing. And then his brother started laughing. And they just had this big, that when they would laugh, it was the greatest. They just started laughing, right? Like, I called your bluff. You're trying to pick a fight? I'm not going there. We're just going to laugh instead. So negativity needs negativity to nurture from. Okay, let's take that up a level. Sin needs a sinner, not the person, the sinner, but the act of sinning to nurture. If you have, or put it in different words, sin needs a sinner to make the sin bad. If I have a gun on the table and I'm using it as a paperweight, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a paperweight. If I pick up the gun with an intention to hurt someone who shouldn't be hurt, the gun becomes a tool for negativity. I give the gun its identity. Before I picked up the gun with an intention to hurt someone, it was just a paperweight. As soon as I picked it up with an intention to hurt someone, it became a tool for negativity. I gave it life, in a sense. Tell me more.
Take yourself.
Good. Right. That's why I said if you pick a gun with an intention to hurt someone who shouldn't be hurt, 100%. If you pick up a gun to protect yourself, if you pick up a gun to defend yourself or to defend your family and so on, it becomes a tool for good, 100%. So let's go let's deviate a little bit. A prohibited relationship, right? The Torah tells us that there are relationships that we're not allowed to engage in. I don't mean to be crass in what I'm going to say, but there's incestuous relationships. Is there anything wrong with your sister? She's a perfectly fine human being. There's nothing unholy about her. She's holy, in fact. But when a person uses their sister in an illicit relationship, the whole thing becomes unholy. In other words, a minute ago, everything was holy. Everything was fine. Everything was neutral, at least. Now, in the act, it becomes unholy. So this concept, this sin, the sin gets its life from the act of sin. If the act of sin isn't there, it dies. The sin dies. If the gun is just sitting as a paperweight, it's just a paperweight. If I pick it up to do something wrong, it becomes wrong. It becomes energized. It gets its life that way. Okay, that's our second layer. That makes sense? Let's take it to the third layer. The third layer is already the spiritual component of that. And that is that all negativity needs to nurture from a holy source. But in order to nurture from a holy source, it nurtures from the negative side of the holy source. The unholy is part of God's master plan, right? God wants there to be free choice. So we have to choose between good and evil, good and bad. So there needs to be a bad. So right now, there's a bad as a concept. It's an energy, and that's the potential for sin. That potential for sin is just an energy. I can either give it life or I can kill it. I kill it by not feeding the energy. I give it life by feeding the energy, meaning engaging in the sin. When I engage in the sin, I give life to that thing. Now, if I'm not commanded not to do that, if the mitzvahs that a Jew is commanded to observe, for the most part, Gentiles are not commanded to observe. There are certain commandments that a Gentile is required to observe that a Jew is not required to observe. So when it comes to one of those prohibitions, and a Jew is faced with a choice to do that act, which is not prohibited for a Jew, and they do it, they don't do anything wrong. They don't give life to this thing because there's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't need the nurture. It's definitely not nurturing from a negative place. Or let's take it to a different place. Let's make this a little easier. You have a Kohen. There's certain prohibitions that a Kohen has that an Israelite doesn't have. So when an Israelite does that particular act, nothing happens. It's all a positive event, at least a neutral event. When a Kohen does that prohibited act, he gives life to the thing that otherwise wouldn't have life. So the Israelite who's engaging in the act just keeps the universe flowing. It's all in its positive flow. When the Kohen does that prohibited act, suddenly the Kohen gave life to something that he could have taken life away from. All unholiness, all of this realm of this negative energy, this realm of the unholy, which is known generally in Kabbalah as Sitra Achra, which means the other side. It's the realm of the impure, nurtures from the backside of holiness. What does it mean, the backside of holiness? I don't mean the backside like you're behind. Backside means not the face. A face is called aponim, right? Ashein aponim. Aponim means pnimius, the inner, the inside, the positive, the inside dimension. The back, achurayim, means the backside. There are things that God created in his world that are pnimius, they're panim, they're inner things, they're the things that God wants. And there are things that God created in a backside way in order to create a playing field. And all of us engage in this kind of dichotomy every single day. There are things that we do because we want to do them, and there are things that we do because they're necessary. The things that we do because they're necessary are not necessarily things that we're enjoying or interested in doing. They're just necessary. They're a necessary part of what we need to do in order to get the things that we really want. We're teaching the JLI course, Advice for Life. So in the first class, it talked about work. is work a means to an end, or is work an end to itself? So the Rebbe explains that the general world concept, the view of society, is that work is a means to an end for the most part. We go to work so we can make money, and then we can use the money to do what we want. Judaism looks at work as an end unto itself. We go to work to make the workspace holy, to influence others, to elevate the money that we earn. The whole objective of work is a holy objective. If we look at work as a means to an end, so it's a necessary evil. Maybe even evil is a strong word. It's a necessary thing we need to do. It's not what we want to do. Let's talk about home ownership, right? Do we love fixing the toilet seat? Nobody loves fixing the toilet. Oh, I can't wait until I can go and do the repairs around my house. Yeah, I'm going to figure out how to fix this and fix that. It's a necessary part. What do I want? I want to have a home. I want to be comfortable at home. What's the experience? The experience is I can come home at the end of the day and I can sit in my chair and I can read my book. I can watch my TV show, listen to my music. And I enjoy the fact that this is my house, that I earned it, and that it's pleasant and it brings calm and peace. King Solomon says, Tiferes Adam L'Sheves Bayis. The beauty of a person, the glory of a person is to sit in their home. Right? There's a certain, look at me, I'm comfortable, I'm at home. But there's a lot of stuff that you need to do in your home in order to have that experience. So God created a world with an objective. There's something he wants out of this world. And that is that we should choose good, that we should do good, that we should make the world a godly place. We should recognize God's presence in the world. That's what God wants. In order for us to achieve that, there has to be this other playing field. There has to be the balance. There has to be a tension there. The tension is all the things that God created to create the tension. But the tension only lives when we feed it. If we don't feed the tension dies. If we don't feed the sin dies. Now, it doesn't die entirely. It dies in this moment, but the concept is out there. And that's a reality until Mashiach comes, until the Messianic era, when the prophet says, Vesruach HaTuma Aver Min Ha'aretz, that God says that I will remove the spirit of impurity, then sin will be dead forever. Then the lights go on entirely. Until then, we prevent sin from being nurtured every time we reject it. Every time we don't feed the negativity, it doesn't work. Hold on one second. I'm just trying to think. I just want to get my train of thought. So where were we going with all of this?
Sid, why is Israel so contentious?
Oh, why is Israel so contentious? Let me finish the thought. So why is Israel so contentious? So the reality of the nations of the world is that they need Israel to nurture. But they need an Israel. They need the holiness to nurture, to survive, as we just discussed. All the flow flows to the world. But it only works when Israel is not doing what it's supposed to do. The forces of negativity need the person to survive. But it only gives them their life when we don't do what we're supposed to do, when we feed their agenda. When we do our agenda, which is to serve God, then the negative forces don't survive. When Israel does, when the Jews live as Jews, when we're in the Holy Land of Israel, nurturing the holiness of the land of Israel and all of its manifestations, when we're united, when we have respect for each other, when we recognize the sacredness of the land of Israel, and we have that mutual respect, then the world steps back. Not because they're afraid of it, but because they can't get anything there. There's nothing there. They can't nurture from the frontal flow of divine energy. They can only nurture from the backside of the divine energy. That's their access point. In in Kabbalistic terminology, it actually uses the term to suckle. Huh?
Is it the land or the people that they
need? It's both. It's the combination. The land is the land because of the people, but it itself is kind of like if the land is aligned with the heaven, it's aligned with the Jewish people also, right? The land is holy in and of itself, and its holiness is manifest its holiness is always there, right? But it's manifest and it's nurtured when we nurture the land. That's why the land of Israel has always been holy, even when Jews weren't there. When the Jews nurture the land, yeah. So that's its contentiousness. And it's kind of like psychologically, like there's this notion of there's a self-sabotaging that people have for the hand that feeds them, right? There's like, it's an arrogance. It's like, you're going to feed me. I'm dependent on you. I'm going to show you I'm not dependent on you. And then what do? You go and sabotage it. It's an arrogance, right? By the way, again, we do this in our relationship with God also. We wake up in the morning and say, I exist. I don't need you, God. We don't necessarily say those words, but we feel those words a little bit. Like why would we ever sin? Why would we ever sin? We only sin because we basically say for that moment, I'm sorry, God, you know, my interests are going to go first right now. What are you talking about? God is feeding you. God is your life force. But our arrogance, which again, doesn't need to mean you're a big shot. The arrogance could mean your preoccupation with your own self-interest, your body, the me, which is the human condition. I'm not being critical. I'm identifying, right? The human condition is me. That's how we come into this world. So in that human condition, we sometimes put ourselves first. That's our job, is to study Torah, to study Chassidus, and bring a greater consciousness of God into our awareness so that we're more aware of where God's presence is. So we are more willing to put ourselves aside and to put God first. But the arrogance of Klippa, the arrogance of the Sitra Achra, the arrogance of this negative force, is that it pushes itself forward to bite the hand that feeds it, and it becomes contentious. Which, again, I don't want to get into the present focus on Israel. I want to focus on the spiritual, but the Rebbe often would say that if Israel would do what it is supposed to do, and it had its own self-confidence, which is a self-confidence that this is God's land that God gave to us, the world would back off. Unfortunately, now we're in a situation where Israel has been forced to take that position. But inherently, that's the way it works. Because when we are confident with who we are, when sin approaches us, when the Sitra Achra approaches us with temptation, and we say, I'm sorry, I'm God's servant, I'm not here to feed the negativity, it goes away. Maybe not the first time, maybe not the second time, but eventually it goes away. Yes.
The lack of recognition that the people in the land are therefore connected as well.
Yes. Tell me your name, please.
Elia.
It's a great question. I'm going to answer. I was thinking about talking about this when you inspired me to talk about it. So I'm going to back into this. We're sitting in a room called Jeff's Place. This is a recovery space. There's a principle in recovery known as letting go of the obsession. So an addict, whatever their addiction is, it could be a substance, it could be alcohol, it could be a drug, an alcohol, it could be a behavior. In the throes of addiction, there's an obsession. There's a constant thinking about the addiction. You may have heard a term called white knuckling, right? Have you heard the expression? So white knuckling is where you're able to practice enough self-control that you don't engage in the behavior of the addiction. But that's not called sobriety. right? You're fighting. You're at war. It's not called sobriety, because sobriety is where you let go. You surrender to this, to the higher power, to your higher power, to God. In the first phase of recovery, when somebody truly embraces recovery, they go through a period of time where they are moving from the obsession into the recovery space. And it's a really hard period of time. Submission. It's a constant, there's a constant ruminating. Okay, I didn't drink for a day. I didn't drink for 2 days. Should I go today? No, maybe I should fight it for another day. Okay, I fought it another day. And then at some point, you have to come to a place where you say, I'm not going to fight anymore. I'm letting go. As the term is, let go and let God. I'm just letting go. I'm not going to hold on to it anymore. So and once a person crosses that line, it doesn't mean they're out of the woods. It just means they're ready to embrace a new path in life. They've had a shift, and they're able to embrace a new path in life that with the community and the structure of AA and whatever other form of recovery, they're able to live differently. Take that same parallel when it comes to sin or when it comes to Israel, right? What's changed? Let's use Israel first. What's changed for Israel between today and 6 months ago? Israel is much more comfortable with saying to the world, we don't care what you think of us. Now, whether they say, we don't care what you think of us, or they say, we can't afford to listen to what you think of us, right? Whatever it is. And by the way, this in Israel is right, left, center. It people who felt otherwise feel very strongly, we don't have the luxury of listening to your opinion, because your opinion is not based on the reality of what we're experiencing here. Your life is not at stake. This is our land. We have an obligation to protect our people, and so on and so forth. There are those voices that are also strongly saying, this is our God-given land, which is really important, right? It's not our land because the UN gave it to us in 48, and it's not our land because that falls short. I mean, it's a good rational argument. It's a good existential argument, but it falls short of this infinite spiritual power, which is, it's our land because God gave us this land. That's what it is, right? But you say it once, and the world pushes back. You say it twice, and the world pushes back. You say it three times, the world stops pushing back so hard. And my son is reading this book called, it's called The Covenant of the Ark, or The Ark of the Covenant. It's a book about the U.S.-Israel relationship going back to the founding of this country. And what's really fascinating, and he shared this with us yesterday, is that we modern Americans, modern American Jews, think that the relationship between the U.S. and Israel is really a modern one, which is that Israel, the United States, needs Israel because it's the only democracy in the Middle East, right? So it's in the U.S.'s interest to make sure that Israel is safe and protected, because otherwise Islamic extremism is going to come to our shores very quickly, more than it has already, right? It has to go back to the founding of this country. It was a religious connection. Founding fathers saw Israel, the land of Israel, as an inherent connection to the identity of what the United States is. It's much deeper than that. Now, if Israel was more comfortable in saying that out loud about itself, this is a very Christian country, the one we live in here now. So even though the haters are making a lot of noise, but this country is founded on those values. And if the Jewish people were to say, hey, this is our God-given land, I don't care what their agenda is. They may have this notion that in order for there to be, you know, the second coming and whatnot, the Jews have to, I don't care, that's fine. As Rabbi Manis Friedman says, you can believe whatever you want as long as you're not accelerating my journey there, right? So fine, just stand back. This is our land. And the Rebbe often said that if Israel spoke strongly with a loud voice and confidence about who it is and why it is, the U.S. would never pressure the U.S. publicly. We know that what we read in the media is not necessarily what goes on behind closed doors. There's all this politicking, right? Netanyahu has to say this, and Biden has to say that, and this politician has to say, they have to say it to keep their constituents happy. It doesn't make a difference what's going on in reality. I mean, not to get into this whole discussion, but one of the issues that we already got into discussion. But anyway, but one of the issues is like everybody's upset that the Netanyahu, I mean, the people that are center and left are upset at Netanyahu that he's making the statement that there's a non-two-state, not going to be a two-state solution, right? Huh? Right. But the point is that he doesn't have to say it. I'm not saying that he shouldn't say it. I'm not going to tell you my personal opinion, but I'm just saying from a political standpoint, it's just ruffling feathers. There's nobody that thinks that there's a two-state solution right now. First of all, give me a two-state solution. We can talk about it. But there is no solution. And nobody in their right mind in the West would think that there's any place for a two-state solution now. Now, maybe, anyway, my point is that those that are antagonistic to Netanyahu are saying that he's making this loud noise because he's playing politics. We know that that's going on. We know that politicking is going on. Biden says things and so on. The U.S. will never pressure Israel to do that which Israel itself is not willing to do. But Israel is willing to do it all too often, or has been. It has been. And because it has been, the world has pushed it. So to answer your question, and to take it back to the personal, the first time, the Medrash has something, says it the opposite way. It says the evil inclination will never come to a person and say, come, let's go worship idols. Right? Why? Because come to a Jew and say, let's go worship idols. Are you kidding me? I'm a Jew. I've never worshiped idols. So that's not how the evil inclination approaches a Jew. Evil inclination approaches a Jew and it says, Hayom omer le'asekach. Today he says, do like this, which means go pray for sure. Today's a day of prayer. Go pray. Make sure that everybody sees how pious you are. Just pray with, you know, shake, keep your eyes closed, like really make it look like you're really holy. But you're doing the right thing. But there's nothing wrong with having people think you're a wonderful person. Do kindness, but make sure everybody else knows you did the kindness, right? What happens? You feed your ego a little bit. Tomorrow, you know, the evil inclination says, you know, everybody already knows that you're like the king of kindness. You don't have to do so much. You don't have to give away all that money. And then the next day it says, you know, everybody knows you're kind. And you really need that money. You need to go and take care of yourself. And slowly, slowly, we suddenly become preoccupied with self. And we suddenly are worshiping ourselves. And then at some point down the line, the evil inclination says, come, let's go worship an idol. And we're ready to do it. Right? So in reverse, if we say, sorry, I'm not your friend. I might come back the next day and say, but I want to be your friend, but I'm not your friend. I don't have anything to do with you. Eventually, they'll go away. Eventually, our particular temptation, our weakness in that area becomes a strength. We're no longer willing to give in that particular thing. We see this in character development all the time, right? We may have a certain weakness or a certain strength. And if we nurture, if we fill in the gap of that weakness, you know, maybe we're a little insecure. We come into an environment. We're not so comfortable saying hello to people. You know, you say, you know what? I know that I have that insecurity. I'm going to walk in today. I'm going to say hello to one person. Here are my questions. I'm going to be prepared. Here are the questions I'm going to ask. You walk into the room. Oh, hello. What's your name? Where are you from? What brings you here today? Great. The next day, you say, I'm going to do it for two people. Does it become easier? A little bit. Doesn't mean your insecurity goes away entirely, but you've learned a new practice. And you learned a new practice, you're able to act on that. So again, the parallel flows all the way through. It has to do with Israel. It has to do with our own weaknesses, the temptations that we face in life, the development of our character. It's a process. It's a process. And when we're consistent with the process, eventually we become in charge, meaning our godly soul, our true identity becomes in charge of what of how we're going to respond, of how we're going to respond in every situation. Just parenthetically, in Tanya, the Alter Rebbe actually, which is all about ultimately pushing ourselves. So the Alter Rebbe says that when you get to a place, this is not going to be, it's not an easy end to the class. The Alter Rebbe says that when you get to a place where that which was difficult for you becomes easy, it's time to take on the next thing. You got to push your limit again. But the point being is that we can get there. Whatever things challenge us, we have the ability to push through and to move past it, for it not to be a challenge. All right, next week we're going to try to figure out what was the spies issue. Have a great week. You're welcome.